welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, travel, turmoil, and perspective navigating Mexico. Our travel expert Alicia Underlee Nelson gives us best advice on how to travel to Mexico today. Plus tech with Peck. What about sound for your TV and your home theater? And we'll also explore the body at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. But first, we open with a closer look with the monitor. Welcome to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. Today on A Closer Look with the Monitor, which is our weekly chat with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor, we're looking at immigration policy and workforce challenges that are capturing attention for many industries right here in North Dakota. Changes in federal visa rules, delays in processing, and new state-level services are having ripple effects across industries and communities. Joining us to break this all down are two North Dakota Monitor reporters this week. Mary Stoyer, she's been covering immigration law developments and state responses, and Jeff Beach, he's been following the economic implications of immigration policy for North Dakota's labor market. Mary and Jeff, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. It's my pleasure to have both of you today. Jeff, I'd like to start with you. Your recent stories have looked at how federal immigration policy is influencing Minnesota and North Dakota businesses in many sectors. What have speakers and economists told you about the connection between immigration policy and labor availability right here in our state?
Yeah, well, I spoke with, especially with Bethany Retirement Services in Fargo, which is a pretty large employer, 800 employees, and they have been using immigrant workers for quite a while, and the healthcare industry has grown more and more dependent on those kinds of nurses, especially from the Philippines. They showed us a map of where their employees are from, and about 300 of the 800 employees that they have are foreign born, and a lot of them from West Africa, actually Liberia, more so than East Africa, Somalia. And the Philippines has been a hotbed for supplying more skilled workers, the nurses that are trained there. They have offers out to employees in the Philippines and are just kind of waiting for the slow process of getting immigration approvals to come across their desks so they can move to Fargo and start working.
From the economy perspective, what have economists then told you about these issues now that are kind of popping up as these different entities of our economy are trying to recruit immigrants to work here?
The statistics bear out that legal immigration has really slowed down in the last year as with the Trump administration, and people are concerned about the availability of workers in lots of sectors. Construction is the number one sector that uses immigrant labor by far. So there are concerns about, being able to fill those jobs as that pipeline kind of goes down to a trickle.
Jeff, in talking with the business leaders that you've had a chance to visit with, what you've talked about is kind of a short-term thing, like a right now thing, but do we have an idea of what the long-term implications are going to be if federal policy stays in place and these folks who want to come and work here can't?
That's really their biggest frustration, is they are fine with the border security that has been put in place, to stop the kind of wave of undocumented workers. But now they are looking for kind of a champion for immigration reform so that immigration policies can spell out how people can get here legally and work here legally and kind of bring back the flow of skilled essential workers, especially. I went to a chamber, Fargo Moorhead, West Fargo Chamber of Commerce event, wasn't expecting to go there writing about immigration, but the main speaker from the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis was asked about immigration and visas right away. And then a panel discussion from more state and regional leaders, pivoted to legal immigration and the need for immigrants to grow the state of North Dakota. And it really was kind of a organic topic that came out of that conference.
Mary, let me turn to you. You've been tracking efforts here in the state to provide legal help to immigrants and employers. And You can explain perhaps the role of the new Immigration Law Service at the University of North Dakota. And Mary, isn't that intended to do exactly that, to provide assistance? And how is it adjusting to the reality that's on the ground today?
Lawmakers established the clinic during the 2025 session. And at the time, it was intended to focus more on helping potential visa workers. So people who want to immigrate to North Dakota and have a job lined up, but just need help with the visa process. The reasoning being, not all companies who are interested in hiring foreign workers necessarily have the means or would offer the means to help them with the legal side of things. So if the clinic could assist people who otherwise wouldn't get that help, more workers would come to North Dakota, and that would alleviate some of the workforce shortage. But what's happening in reality is the director of the clinic, Eric Rezik, he says they haven't really seen demand for that kind of assistance. They've had a couple of inquiries for help filing visas, but those just didn't end up going anywhere. And he said a big reason for this is probably because now it costs quite a bit more for employers to file applications for H-1B visas, which are for those skilled workers. It used to cost, I believe, a few thousand dollars, and the federal government announced in the fall that they were raising that to $100,000. So he thinks that's likely curbing a lot of the interest in that program. And so instead, what the clinic is focusing on is helping immigrants who are already here in North Dakota but aren't working with other types of legal services, like, for example, asylum or naturalizations. And he said that when you file those sorts of things, usually if those applications are pending for a certain amount of time, that opens up a path for them to apply for work permits. And so that's sort of how they're trying to preserve the intent of the legislature to get people working, even if it's not in the way they thought it was going to go at the beginning.
Another part of your reporting talks about delays in federal immigration system today. We're hearing from immigrants and employers who are stuck in those backlogs. And so what kinds of frustrations do we hear from either employers or immigrants themselves?
Well, one of the big frustrations is that they're just not hearing anything, you know, that they've put in applications and either have had hearings canceled or just not getting anything scheduled, and they're just kind of sitting there waiting. And, you know, there are groups like refugees from Ukraine that are here. They're being put in a tough spot because they they need money, but they are not legally allowed to work. So it's, as one kind of immigration advocate said, you know, it's putting people's lives in danger. There are groups in volunteer groups too in the Fargo-Moorhead area and elsewhere that try to help these folks out with paperwork and, you know, especially with the language barrier. Some of them don't have great English skills. So just kind of navigating the paperwork is even just daunting to begin with. And then once you get that done, you're just kind of in hurry up and wait mode.
Mary, given those delays that Jeff has talked about and the fee increases that you've talked about for certain visas, do we know how local advocates or state leaders are responding? Are there plans or proposals to help mitigate these hurdles for North Dakota workplaces and families? Or is this wait for the federal government to solve the issue?
As far as I know, I think it's sort of in the federal government's hands. I do know that for the $100,000 fee, there are a few lawsuits against the Trump administration related to that change. And so, I mean, that could change the situation. I did hear from the Global Talent Office, which was previously the state's Office of Legal Immigration, that they're trying to pivot to trying to get international students working in North Dakota. And they said that that's a different class of visa. And so the $100,000 fee doesn't apply to them. But then the other thing I think I want to note is that, so there's another significant category of visa for seasonal agricultural workers, the H-2A visas. And I've heard different things as to whether or not those have actually been impacted by the federal government. Eric speculated that changes in immigration policy might be discouraging people from applying to those, specifically like if they fall under, in some cases, people from some countries literally can't get them now just because of the travel bans the Trump administration has put into place. But the North Dakota Job Service, who helps employers who are trying to get employees on those work visas in North Dakota, they've said they haven't really noticed a difference in the amount of demand that they're seeing. So it remains to be seen what the situation with that is.
Jeff, I want to wind this up with you. Back to the panel discussion, perhaps, that you attended in West Fargo. Are business groups proposing any policy alternatives or pathways that are interesting and worth discussion?
Actually, Eric Spencer from the Greater North Dakota Chamber, who was on that panel, and Shannon Full, who's the executive director of the Fargo-Moorhead-West Fargo Chamber, both said that they were part of a kind of a national group, chamber type group that is trying to attack this from the business side, which, you know, kind of shows you that that's you know, maybe the group that is able to build some momentum for the legal immigration changes that they say are needed.
My thanks to both of you, North Dakota Monitor reporters Mary Stoyer and Jeff Beach, for giving us insight into how immigration policy, federal backlogs, and state efforts are shaping North Dakota's workforce challenges. And the fact is that they're real and they potentially could be long-lasting and may impact the economy right here in North Dakota. To catch up on their reporting, fantastic reading, you can read more about these developments. Just visit northdakotamonitor.com. It's free from subscriptions or paywalls. That's it for this edition of A Closer Look with the Monitor. Thanks, Mary and Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Support for Bray Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, helping families reach their dreams throughout the Bismarck-Mandan area. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and with spring break just a few weeks away, many North Dakotans are asking now a pressing question. Is it safe to travel to Mexico? According to reporting in this week's New York Times, unrest erupted after the killings of a cartel leader, triggered gunfights, fires, roadblocks, and temporary shelter-in-place alerts for United States citizens in Guadalajara and Puerto Vallarta, very popular destinations, and the State Department now has changed maybe their travel advisories, and we want to get through all of this, visiting with Alicia Underlee-Nelson. She joins us periodically to talk about travel. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Alicia, when you saw the reporting about a shelter in place in places like Puerto Vallarta, what was your immediate reaction as a travel professional?
Well, my immediate reaction, of course, was worry for the folks that live and work in Mexico, right? Because they're the ones that are primarily affected by this cartel-related violence. And anytime there's a power vacuum, as there was when this leader was taken down, there's going to be people that are going to want to prove that they have that turf. And the people of Mexico are the ones that suffer the most, of course. And I think I always am dismayed when there are negative headlines about a destination, because that tends to be the only coverage of Mexico in this instance that many Americans ever see. And of course, no country is defined by its most recent or most negative headlines. So I always want to encourage people like to take that with a grain of salt, to be consulting local Mexican media and local media and influencers coming out of the cities that are affected to get a better and more nuanced understanding. Because sometimes, you know, U.S. journalists are people too, and sometimes our own biases come into play. Sometimes we have that main character syndrome that I talked about the last time I came on this program, where we think everything applies to us and we are the center of the universe, and we tend to filter our news and stories through what is most important to us. So, like, yep, it definitely is relevant to those of us that are traveling to these regions. We're going to have to make some decisions. But, of course, it's important to remember that there's a broader context here, and to take a breath and to think, okay, do I need to worry or do I not need to worry? And then, of course, to do our best to root on our friends and maybe family members and colleagues in Mexico, of which I have several, that have to deal with this kind of thing on the ground.
You know, one thing that I noticed when I started looking into what the advisories were, and as you remarked just before we came on the air, they change so often, but some states are level one, some are level two, others are level three, and these are advisories published by the U.S. Department of State. So if someone has a spring break trip planned, how can they get the most up-to-date information on what's going on? And then, Alicia, I want you to cover one more thing when we're talking about that. Oftentimes, it's been my mind that resorts are separate from where a lot of violence is going on. Is that true? So two parts to the question there.
Sure. I think the first thing that you need to consider is where you are going. In order to for these warnings to make a lot of sense, it's smart to kind of imagine the map of Mexico in your mind. And for those of you for whom geography was a few years ago, it can help to look at the country. It's a big country, about a fifth the size of the United States. So just because there's violence happening in one state doesn't mean that there's violence happening in all states. So the places that you really need to look at, if you've already got a trip booked, we'll start there. There's a lot of regional variation. So there are do not travel warnings up right now. And this did just update. As I mentioned, this has changed about three or four times since we set up this interview. So I imagine it's going to change again, right, as you get closer to your trip date. So you're going to want to check in with the State Department, see what they're saying. They're going to have some steps and some advisories for you to check in with folks so they can track you and know where you are. But there are do not travel level four, which is pretty rare, for six states, including several that are popular with Western tourists. And that includes Sinaloa, Mazatlan, the area around Puerto Vallarta, the state Guerrero that includes Acapulco. There's several different places. And then there's, this is just recently new, updated. There's certain areas, so it's not the entire state for all of these places. But there's like around Veracruz, several Puebla, several different places, but it might not be the entire state. So if you imagine, like, we'll think of the state of North Dakota, for instance, if there's something happening on the streets of Fargo, that's not going to affect folks in Williston, right? But to people that are outside the country, might be like, oh my gosh, there's something horrible happening in North Dakota. But those of us that have a more nuanced understanding of geography are going to understand there's an awful lot of distance between those two cities. They're very different culturally. They're very different politically. They're very different geographically, right? And so our friends and family closer to the ground and the local officials there are going to be giving the information to our consulate and updating them as they go. So what I would really encourage people to do, if you're traveling, this is primary, the main do not travel areas are kind of located along the western and southern border of the U.S. and then as well as on the Pacific coast. And there's a few others that we need to kind of keep an eye on as well. But look at those. If you have something planned for other regions, right? So look, if you're going to Cancun or you're going to Tulum, which is on the eastern side of the country, Playa del Carmen is also there in Quintana Roo. That just is, they're advising increased caution. That's a level two. That's the same as Baja California Sur, the same as if you're going to Mexico City. So they're just saying, okay, if that's the case, you don't have to cancel your trip, okay? You don't have to worry. You don't have to stress. But you're just going to have to be aware and be a smart traveler as you would before. So there's a lot of daylight between those two things, right? And then you've got a level three somewhere in the middle for several other states. So there just isn't one blanket answer. It depends on where you're going, and it depends on when. Because I spoke to folks in Puerto Vallarta, and the situation has changed there. They had a shelter in place on Sunday night. That has lifted. Flights are, you know, going in and out. They've got people going internationally now. So it just kind of depends, right? It depends moment by moment, day by day. If you already have a trip booked, you're going to have to look at it. You're going to have to check in, sign up for the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program, or STEP. That's a free way that allows U.S. citizens and U.S. nationals to let the Department of State know that you're going abroad and that you let them know exactly where you're going in Mexico, right? So you can sign up, you'll get updates about what's going on the ground there. And that also helps the embassy or the consulate contact you if there happens to be an emergency like civil unrest, because it does happen. No matter how well you plan, these things can happen, right? It also tells you where to go, where the local embassy is. You get updates on health, weather, and safety, right? So if you've done that, you're in a level two situation, you feel like you're safe, all right, then you're just going to use common sense, right? You're going to monitor local media for updates. You're going to connect with people that you know on the ground there. You're going to maybe stay away from crowds. And that's kind of where maybe if you're in a tourist resort, it's a little bit different. Traditionally, at a lot of these big all-inclusive resorts or package deals that you might get, those are both geographically and culturally very removed from everyday life in Mexico. And a lot of the people that are really affected by this, again, are just everyday Mexicans living and working that are not able to take the bus. They're not able to go to their workplace. There are roadblocks and checkpoints in place, right? So if you are at an all-inclusive resort or a package property, you're going to be geographically removed from that. You're going to be culturally removed from that as well. That resort will probably have its own security, and you might feel a bit more secure there because you likely will be more secure there, right? You're also going to want to, no matter where you go, and this is good for every trip, let your family and friends know your location,
sure.
Know where you're at. I always, when I go on any trip anywhere, I leave for my friends and my parents, you know, what hotels we're going to be at, how our itinerary looks, that kind of thing, just so they know where we're at and they can keep an eye on us. That helps everybody feel a little bit more secure, right? And a lot of people have been asking me, well, how should we trust the hotel? I mean, like, of course they want us to pay the money and come, but how do we know they're going to help us? Well, I would say, you know, again, the geography matters, the type of security that they have matters, and they're going to be very, I have a background in hospitality, so trust me, they are anticipating these questions. And they're not going to want to risk a lawsuit or risk their staff coming in if it's truly terrible either. You know, they have to do what's right for the people that live and work there. They want to live and thrive and do business for weeks and months and years in the future, right? So if it's too dangerous, they will let you know. But if you're in a level two area, right, and things are still moving, that is truly up to you and your risk tolerance. I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer. So if you have a trip booked, you're going to have to take it kind of day by day. Keep checking in, keep seeing, because a lot of these, some places have gotten much better in 24 hours and some places have gotten much worse. And that's just sort of the nature. This type of violence, I really want to state too, the cartels are not Mexico, right? They do not represent Mexico. They are not a normal or accepted occurrence. Like, Mexico is not a hotbed of violence. This is just a particularly violent transitional time. And a few citizens of Mexico are making life really miserable for other people. But that is something that the local authorities are handling. That is something that the military is handling. And that's going to play itself out in a way that we can't predict. And that unpredictability is scary, right? But as travelers, we are largely isolated from that. And if you're nervous about it, then certainly plan your next trip for someone at somewhere else, you know? And if you need to cancel the trip, some of your travel insurance will cover that. So that's probably something to discuss too.
I think the advice you gave about enrolling in STEP, that is the Smart Traveler Enrollment Program, free service from the U.S. Department of State, is a great, great piece of advice. Their website is step.state.gov, and we visit periodically with travel writer Alicia Underley Nelson. She joins us today, and she's a freelance writer and photographer who specializes in immersive travel stories, hidden history, outdoor adventures, and in this case, good advice for present-day concerns. You can read more about her work at prairiestylefile.com. Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you.
Still ahead on Main Street, Tech with Peck. Our tech expert, George Peck, tells us how to make our television and home theater sound better. Plus, we'll explore the body with the North Dakota Gateway to Science. That's still ahead on Main Street, right after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and it's time for Tech with Peck, our weekly conversation with George Peck about the technology that shapes our lives. And you've invested in a big, beautiful television, or maybe bit on one of the projectors we've been talking about here the last few weeks. You may have noticed something surprising. The picture keeps getting better, but maybe not the sound. Well, not always anyway. From sound bars to surround sound to room acoustics, at home can be more complicated, it seems, and George is with us today to figure all of this sound business out. George, welcome back.
Well, thank you. And it's interesting in that, you know, my first career, interesting where we are, was radio. And so sound was a very early important part of my life and continues to be. And this is probably my favorite segment so far. And it hasn't even happened yet. So,
well, we'll get right after it.
The potential to be the favorite segment.
Well, you talked to us last week about the cool new RCA color television you found for Christmas. But one of the things that I've noticed, George, is when you tear those old TVs apart, you see a larger speaker. And now we have these razor thin televisions that to me often don't sound as good as the old stuff did. So what is it that we need to know? Let's start with television first. When our complaint is, I can't hear the dialogue or the explosions are too loud, what should we do?
Well, I suppose buy an audio system. I think that's probably the best answer, because if you think about the televisions, that the good old RCA color from the 1970s or whenever 60s, it had a real speaker in it. I mean, it had some depth and it, you know, moved
big
a little
magnet.
Bit of sound.
Yeah.
Now, my beautiful LG OLEDs, organic LEDs, we talked about those last week, are so thin. The panel itself is, you know, fractions of an inch. Now, the electronics, the guts towards the bottom are a little bit bigger. But where do you get sound out of a very thin device where before you had room for a speaker? So there are various forms of speakers and televisions that are built in. In my case, I think I heard each of those televisions built-in speakers once when I took it out of the box, mounted on the wall, and turned it on because I wanted to see what it looked like before I hooked anything else up. And then after that, I've never heard the speaker since. And again, I'm an audio fanatic. It is potentially as much, if not more important than the video. So I need good audio. And my experience simply is that the built-in speakers in a television, especially a thin speaker, simply isn't sufficient. So my personal take is it's not a physical possibility with a small speaker, in many cases pointing to the out of the back of the television. So it's not even pointing at you when you're listening, it's pointing against the wall. So it's going to bounce off the wall or bounce off something. It's just not a physical scenario for good sound, period.
So what are the options? What are the options, George? What should we look at? Maybe we can start with a sound bar.
Yeah.
That's the simple one.
So I'm going to be a sound bar snob, and I will have to admit to not having listened to lots of sound bars. But I think I have the same somewhat basic complaint with a sound bar that I had with a speaker built into the television, although obviously not as much. It's a dedicated device for emitting sound. I think the question I have about a sound bar is, if you are looking to get real surround sound, that I think is an important part of the theater experience. You hear the dialogue coming out of the middle of the screen. You hear left and right channels of stereo audio coming out. But most theaters in the world for the last 30 years have had surround. There are speakers behind you and speakers to the sides. And that immersive experience is something that a soundbar attempts to, impart with trickery, for lack of a better word. And I think it's better than the built-in speakers in the television, certainly. And if that's kind of what your room allows and that's what your budget allows, go for it. But if your budget can stand a little more, go for a real sound system with real dedicated speakers. You will enjoy a much better experience.
So when we're looking at those sound systems, George, with dedicated speakers, for me, wires are the big thing that I just almost don't even want to think about. There are wireless options out there. Can you tell me the difference? And if we're really looking at that great sound that you want to capture, what we ought to think about?
I really am an audio geek and purist, Craig. And it's to a certain extent unfair to you and to who's listening to us, because I'm going to tell you that wireless is a compromise, because in order to transmit audio wirelessly, you have to compress it in order to avoid latency, which means you don't want the back speakers to be a half a second later than the front speakers, or to get lip sync problems with the video. You've got to, compress it so that it's not going to be delayed. all those things, at least on paper or an oscilloscope. Is an oscilloscope still a thing that you make? Oh, yeah, whatever. A spectrum analyzer.
My dad used to have one. I thought it was cool. Okay.
Yeah. it's gonna affect it. But I think ultimately wireless is probably gonna be okay. I run speaker wires to my rear channels, and I actually got here's an idea. I took lamp cord, which is an interesting speaker wire, white lamp cord. I have white trim in my living room. I got two-sided white tape. I put it on the trim and then took the two lamp cords and put them on the white tape going on top the white trim. And you can't really even see it's there. So if you can do some very creative ways of hiding the wires, you will get a wired speaker system. You don't have the compression issues. You don't have any of the audio loss. And you don't see them. If you can do it, it's a good way to solve that problem.
How many speakers do we need, George? There's
how many you got? How many you got?
There's a center speaker. There's two up front. Then we have surround sound, Dolby 5.1. Now we got Atmos. What do we need?
Yeah. So need is there's always the question of need versus want.
Yeah.
And so if we all remember the original, at the talkies, all right. So the first theater I went to was probably in our hometown of Riverton, Wyoming, and that had three big, probably Electro Voice speakers behind the screen, but they were all carrying the same thing. It was mono. And I remember when Dolby Stereo made its entry into the movie theater.
The Acme Theater, George?
I don't think they had Dolby Stereo, at least not when I still lived there. I had to go to Casper or to Billings or something for that. But I would go to a movie if it had a Dolby Stereo soundtrack, even if it was a piece of garbage. I saw many bad movies that sounded good because I wanted to hear that sound. And then we got into surround sound. But stereo was the first beautiful movie experience for me, and that took two speakers. If you want, get two speakers. But as surround sound has become more prevalent, not only in theaters commercially, but in homes, you need probably three. And the idea is you have a center channel speaker in the middle of your television set, or right below it or right above it, or behind it if it's a screen and you want to get a sound transparent screen. And now you have the dialogue coming right out of the face. And that's the experience of where that sound is coming from. And now you have sound effects out of the left speaker and out of the right speaker and music, full stereo music coming out of the left and right. So I would say that's the bare minimum. Now, the original first home theater surround environment was what was called 5.1, Dolby Digital. Dolby is this name we hear a lot. Again, I'm Ray Dolby, who founded all this. And the Dolby Digital 5.1 standard had the center channel, which was where vocals came from, left front, left right, and then rear left and right. So now you had sound that could come behind you. And the dot one, so that's the five in 5.1, left, center, right, left, rear, right, rear, five. Dot one is the subwoofer. And the subwoofer is for that deep bass that's going to make your neighbors call the cops, all right?
And where should we locate that subwoofer, George?
So that's a good question. Depends on your room. I generally look to place a subwoofer in a corner against some hard walls or maybe a little away from the hard walls. In my current downstairs, I don't have any hard walls. All I have is soft velvet curtains. But I've got two main speakers that actually have built-in subwoofers, and I've got a third subwoofer kind of in between them. So it's a little bit cheating because I've got three of them. In the theater I had previously that I custom built, I actually had two subwoofers, one in the front and one in the back. So depends on the room. If you've just got one, generally I think the rule is kind of find a corner. I think the other rule is listen in various places and see where it sounds best. And it'll also depend to a certain extent where you're sitting.
Sure. Try it first. And now we have Atmos, George. Tell us about that.
So Atmos again is a Dolby standard. So Dolby had originally 5.1, then it went to 7.1. So with 7.1, we had left, front, right, front, center. And then we had left and right, middle, that would be kind of right at your ear level. And then left and right, rear, that would be behind you. So that was 7.1. And the next was Dolby Atmos, and Atmos is now a standard where you can have theoretically 64 or more speakers that wow. each will have a different bit of audio coming out of them. So what I have done with my Atmos system is I have my 7-1. So I've got my left, right, center, front, left, right, center beside my ears, left, right, rear, that's 7. And now I've put 4 in the ceiling, left, right, front ceiling, and left, right, rear ceiling. The other options are height, left and right, front height, and they can go from there. And the idea of Atmos is that the mixer, the soundtrack, can have audio in any combination of those speakers. And so the experience can be fantastic, provided that the mixer who produced the soundtrack made full use of it. So a couple of great new movies that make use of it. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 2, the very beginning scene, the sound is going all through the room. Top Gun Maverick, great sound going all through the room. Sinners, great soundtrack. So the Dolby Atmos now I'm being made use of is just so immersive. I watched the Eras Tour, not the movie, but the actual last night in Vancouver on Disney Plus. That was 4K Ultra HD and Dolby Atmos. And it was like being in this stadium. So Atmos can be absolutely beautiful if it's properly mixed.
I'm sure we could talk about sound a lot, George, but we're gonna end it there for now. That's George Peck with Tech with Peck. Helps makes us smarter, maybe finally understand what everyone in that movie is actually saying. George, thanks for being with us again on Main Street.
Okay.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, providing live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery for in-person, hybrid, and virtual events, serving clients throughout the Upper Midwest and nationwide. More at livewirenow.com.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, stay with us, because coming up next, we'll shift from today's local conversations to the wider national and global picture. The news cycle can sometimes feel like a runaway train, fast, relentless, hard to follow, and all things considered takes a different approach. It slows the pace, adds depth and perspective, and guides you thoughtfully through the day's most important stories, context, clarity, and reporting you can trust. That's all things considered. Coming up next, right after Main Street. And at 8 p.m. this evening on Prairie Public, it's The Middle, live with Jeremy Hobson. With rising prices and high mortgage rates, even though they've dipped just a bit, owning a home is a fading part of the American dream for many. So how is the housing market affecting you? That's on The Middle tonight at 8 p.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are pleased to be joined by Hope Brodolsky. She's a STEM education specialist at North Dakota's Gateway to Science in Bismarck. It's a beautiful place, a wonderful asset for our state. Hope, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Periodically, we spotlight a couple of exhibits at the Gateway to Science, and we're going to talk about stuff that happens inside our bodies today.
Yes.
The Vein Finder and the Blood Superhighway. Mm-hmm. Tell me more.
So I picked two this month because I feel like they go perfectly together. One of which is our Vein Finder. And this Vein Finder uses some really cool technology that allows you to put your arm underneath a specific type of light, and then it actually shows where the veins are. And I really love this one because I've actually been able to see it in action. During college, I was a part of Dance Marathon at UND, and we got to tour the Children's Miracle Network Hospital in Fargo. And this is something that they use every single day to make the experience better for those kiddos. And so it's cool to see that we are able to have it in our space and see that people are actually using it in their everyday careers, especially as doctors, nurses, phlebotomists. And so with that, it then moves into our blood superhighway, which is a really cool exhibit that is quite large. It wraps around the area that it's in, and our blood superhighway splits into two parts. It is our heart that's in the middle, and there is a flow that goes into the artery, which is going away from the heart. It's the oxygenated blood that goes towards the rest of the body, and then the veins actually bring it back to the heart, and so it brings it back to be reoxygenated. And in the blood superhighway, we also have the different particulates that are in your blood, like the white blood cells, the plasma, the white blood cells. And so with the blood superhighway, it's a really great visual to show that everything is connected, but then it also flows through the heart and all around your body.
Let's talk about scale here. The scale matters because this is kind of larger, and it allows people to kind of immerse themselves into what's really happening. Give me an idea of the fact that it is larger than real life and why that is important.
Yes, with our blood superhighway, it's a really great model. And models are something that we use in science that allow us to have really small things as larger or really big things as smaller. Like if we're thinking about the solar system, we can't fit that into one room because it's the solar system. And so we have to make that smaller. But with our blood superhighway, it runs through our entire body. And so with it, it's incredibly long because it has to bring that blood to all of our extremities. And so with it, we have to make it a bigger model to make it easier to understand. And so with this one, you can actually wrap your hands around it and feel the heart pulse, which is going to then send the blood to the rest of the body.
Sounds so cool. It really does. So whether you're interested in using near infrared light to look at blood as it circulates in veins or the blood superhighway, certainly the North Dakota Gateway to Science is a place where you can really get those little minds thinking maybe about a lot of things otherwise they wouldn't think about. Hope, tell us when you're open again. Remind our viewers how they can come and visit.
Yes. So our hours depend on the day. We are closed on Tuesdays currently for maintenance. On Wednesdays, we are open early at 9 a.m. and we close at 5. Thursdays, we open at 10 and we're open until 7 p.m. So that way you can come after work as well. On Fridays and Saturdays, we're open from 10 to 5. Sundays, 1 to 5. And then Mondays, 10 to 5.
That's Hope Berdulski. She's the STEM education specialist at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Hope, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. And it's always a pleasure to help spread the word about North Dakota's Gateway to Science. What a gem.
Thank you for having me.
Dakota Geriatrics presents Age-Friendly Healthcare for American Indian Elders, a virtual webinar for providers, healthcare professionals, and community workers working with American Indian populations. March 4th from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Information at dakotageriatrics.org.
This is Bird Note. The bearded reedling is a wetland songbird that's enjoying a boom in both population and popularity. The birds have rufous bodies, a light gray cap, and white faces, but bearded reedlings are named for the male's striking black facial markings that resemble a Fu Manchu mustache, or maybe make up for the rock band Kiss. It gives the bird a stern expression at odds with their diminutive size. Barely larger than a chickadee, the male reedlings are often photographed with their feathers puffed out to near spherical proportions, their spindly legs grasping parallel stalks as if performing the splits. These images are so delightful that search results for roundest bird in the world serve up a gallery of reedlings. The internet's favorite borb is also a remarkable comeback story. Reedlings breed across much of Europe and Central Asia, but in the United Kingdom, where they're called bearded tits, a confluence of harsh winters and habitat loss reduced their numbers to just two pairs by the 1940s. Thanks to decades of intensive reed bed restoration and the bird's capacity to rear several broods in a season, there are now more than 600 breeding pairs of bearded reedlings in the UK today. So, don't be fooled by that adorable scowl. These wetland wonders can give us all something to cheer for.
Any hobby or special interest has its own jargon. You'll pick up on the silly slang that birders use as you go, like calling the yellow-rumped warbler butterbutt. Still, learning a few basics of bird vocab is useful when you're starting out. It'll help you ask better questions when you're confused. And there's a good place to look for those vocab terms: the opening pages of a bird field guide. Most of the book is made up of species descriptions, but the first few sections have general info about what to call the different parts of a bird, basics on bird behavior, and birding tips. So it's a quick and helpful read before a trip to find birds. For now, here are a few vocab words to get you started. The feathers on top of a bird's head are called the crown. Bird vocalizations come in two general types: songs, used to attract mates, and calls, with other meanings such as alarm or just, "Hey, I'm over here." The bright white lines found on many songbirds' wings are called wing bars. Like any language, the more you immerse yourself, the faster you'll learn. I'm Jonice Franklin.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 26th. In North Dakota, a woman coaching high school basketball remains rare enough to make headlines. As recently as January of 2026, the Fargo Forum profiled the only two women coaching basketball in the state's highest sports classification. Both led girls' teams. A woman coaching boys' basketball is rarer still. The Dickinson Press highlighted one of the few women in North Dakota coaching a boys' team at any level, also in January of 2026. While no national data tracks women coaching boys' high school sports, a 2014 Minnesota survey found women made up just 2% of coaches for boys' teams across all sports. Although women continued to break barriers in high school basketball coaching in the 2020s, they weren't the first to do so in North Dakota. On this date in 1978, both the Fargo Forum and Grand Forks Herald reported on Gwynne Herman, the state's only female boys' basketball coach at the time. Gwynne Herman grew up in Beulah, where her love of sports flourished despite very limited athletic opportunities for girls. After graduating from Dickinson State University in 1970, she began her teaching and coaching career in Max, where she founded the girls' track and basketball programs. In the fall of 1976, she moved to Hamden to teach geography and business and coach the girls' basketball team. When Hamden High School boys' basketball coach resigned in January of 1978, the school board approached Gwynne about taking over. After a few days of consideration, she accepted and immediately got to work. She earned the boys' respect after the first practice, and none questioned having a woman as their coach. Gwynne found little difference between coaching boys and girls, aside from the inconvenience of announcing herself before entering the locker room. The Hamden community fully supported her, and referees and opposing coaches quickly adapted to seeing a woman on the sidelines. Assistant coach Dale Schonauer welcomed working under her leadership. As Hamden resident Dennis Werner put it, "Miss Herman's a good coach. She knows the game of basketball as well as anyone." Gwynne never set out to be a trailblazer in the women's movement, but she firmly believed in equal access to education and employment opportunities. She hoped more women would enter coaching. As she put it, "If a man can coach girls' teams, why not a woman coaching boys? I believe people should be hired on their qualifications." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Thursday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to Main Street as one of your favorite podcasts. Coming up tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's a re-air of The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. And at 7 p.m. Central tomorrow, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll look forward to seeing you again Monday right here on Main Street.